This episode of We Are Libertarians is brought to you by Audible.com. Enjoy one free audiobook courtesy of We Are Libertarians. Choose from more than 100,000 audiobook titles, including works by Ron Paul, Walter Block, Murray Rothbard, and the Cato Institute. Audible.com also has audio of radio and TV programs and audio versions of magazines and newspapers. You can get the Audible app on any mobile device or download the audio to your computer. Go to audibletrial.com/WAL or head to WeAreLibertarians.com and find the link to get one free month of Audible today. Welcome to We Are Libertarians for this week, or week-ish, as it were. This is the triumphant return of me.
Dear Leader.
Dear Leader, the president of all libertarians, which I'll explain in a minute. I am Chris Spangle, your host, returning from a sabbatical. A nice little vacation. I missed you all dearly, except for Josiah Crones, who is the world's worst listener.
He really is, isn't he?
He is the worst. And I will get to things that I learned. But Greg Lenz, to my left, is the only one here. It's an intimate We Are Libertarians here.
Yes, it is, in fact, very intimate.
Very quiet.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Right. We're broadcasting from the new world headquarters of We Are Libertarians, which we won't explain, but we got a brand new place. We got the fireplace going. We're looking out over the lake. It's beautiful here.
Chris, so. You're looking very very relaxed. You prepared a bottle of wine and some candles when I walked in. I wasn't entirely sure how to proceed.
We need to hurry up and get you out of here. Oh, my. Well, thank you to Joe Ruiz and Dan Peffers and Greg Lenz, especially Joe and Greg, for handling the hosting duties while I was out. I needed some personal time away, and I didn't want to leave everybody disappointed. As most of you know, I am the person who founded We Are Libertarians and owns all the equipment and knows how to do all this stuff. I work in radio for a living, so you know, it's a foreign concept running even this tiny little board and editing the audio and doing all this stuff for Greg, especially.
God bless Fiverr.com. No kidding. You were a lifesaver, Fiverr.com.
How many Malaysians edited last week's podcast?
I deployed a team of Malaysians that are all missing now.
Oh.
Too soon.
Too soon. And then Joe Ruiz. Joe works in radio. Joe's on the sales side, but still, he's got some chops. So you know, and clearly a very talented individual himself. So can't thank you guys enough. But I do have some things that I learned. You know, while I was away, it didn't mean that I wasn't listening. Above all else, I am a listener of this program.
Oh, no.
Which is why I hate it so much. So, so much. But I learned a few things over the past few episodes. Not much.
Am I being thrown under the bus?
I didn't learn much, but I did learn the following things that I would like to highlight. So in case you missed, in case you skipped, in case you're the Chris Spangle fan out there and you were the one guy that didn't listen to the last four episodes, did you do three or four without me? Three that we posted, one that we haven't.
One that's just Creighton and I, and
oh,
I don't want to lose all six listeners. That would now granted, we'd probably pick up the entire GOP.
Right.
However, I couldn't do that to Wall.
Okay, so here's what I learned over the last few episodes. I learned that Joe Ruiz has a brand new podcast on this network. He started one while I was gone, and it is our culture and arts podcast. It's called The Cap, and it's actually pretty good.
It's really good.
It
I
is.
Listen every week.
It's on its ninth episode.
And I hate podcasts.
Yes. I learned that they're actually called Mazel Tov cocktails, Greg.
They are.
Not Molotov cocktails.
I had drank in too many cocktails. That's why I mispronounced it.
I also learned, Greg, another fact about you, that you would, in fact, nuclear bomb Holocaust victims.
Well, threaten.
Threaten,
see,
okay.
It's all about strategy. Chess.
I learned, and this is the one truthful fact out of everything that I learned that you mentioned, I learned that the United States couldn't fulfill an order of gold from Germany.
Mm-hmm, correct.
So, which I found that to be enlightening. I learned that Batman is available for low-rated libertarian podcast if you just ask him nicely. I learned that if Greg and Dan come over to your apartment, they will leave the door open, allowing your wife to escape. I've learned, and this is the most important thing I've learned that everyone associated with this network is a complete nerd, and it's amazing that any of us have ever touched a boob, including Gina.
Actually, you know what? That's entirely true.
Yes.
If we were to start a libertarian dating site, we would only be able to solicit to male same-sex couples.
So I was gone for approximately 2 months. I missed four-ish episodes. Only one person, only Richard James McGurr missed me. That was it. He was the only one who wrote in to say, come back to Wall, I miss you.
I missed you more than anyone because I thank Joe Ruiz, and Joe is a natural host. Like, he's just great at it. I couldn't even pay attention. I was like a crack-riddled monkey. I had no idea what was going on. I threatened to nuke the Jews, I'm pretty sure.
You did.
And I was I have no recollection of that. That's how nervous I was.
You don't remember saying that you were going to nuke Holocaust victims?
I have no recollection of saying
that. Terrible.
But I can... You know, safely say the Israeli lobby will not be contributing to We Are Libertarians.
I learned that after 2 months, I still don't miss Josiah Crohn's.
No. And I miss him like I miss Crohn's disease.
Right. That's not how you say his name. I will not give him the benefit of having his name said correctly on this program. He called me fat on Facebook one time, and thus you will be the most hated listener of all time to this program. I learned... This is an important and disturbing fact about Joe Ruiz. I learned that if given the option of having an African-American man named Rashad on the program or the whitest person in the entire Libertarian Party, our director of minority outreach, Joe Ruiz, will choose Dan Van Doren.
Yeah, he did.
I listened to that episode. It gets to the end, and our director of minority outreach says, oh, hey, by the way, we want to say hi to Rashad, who runs... a Facebook page, which is escaping me now. I should have put it in my notes. You know, way to plug it at the end.
Well, see, here's the thing. Is
really
Joe,
promoting racial racial diversity on We Are Libertarians.
Joe is a competitive minority. So he's...
Okay. All right.
Only kidding, bro.
Hello, hello. Crank call. and lastly, I learned that Dr. Mark Thornton is an excellent guest. I listened to that episode on the way Saturday night out to give a speech about We Are Libertarians to the Henry County Libertarian Party. Listened to it on the way out there. Dr. Mark Thornton knocked it out of the park, just covered so many subjects in such a great way. You asked fantastic questions. Joe did a great job hosting the podcast. So...
that was
very good work, gentlemen.
That was so much fun, and I could have probably, like, and I know I probably dominated and hogged it, so if you're not a me fan, one, I don't blame you, and two, I apologize for taking up that much of your time. But I could have sat there and just talked to Dr. Thornton the entire time. I loved it, and I can't wait to have him back on.
Yeah, so very good job. You know,
were you disappointed, though, that we were so bad?
You guys weren't bad. No, I've said this a lot in the past, that We Are Libertarians is fortunate enough to have enough people that are really talented and good that they can host a middling podcast like ours in the events that I get hit by a bus. So, you know,
now you weren't a Canadian gulag.
We have just enough people to be mediocre.
Well, Joe's great though.
And I am the head of the Peter Principle here. You
You've come very far.
Yeah. I forgot the bit. I forgot the bit that we were supposed to do. I have to edit that in, though.
You do. You were kidnapped by Canadians.
I was kidnapped by Canadians. Yes, I am smelling of maple syrup. That is our new location. We are now in a Canadian bacon factory.
Saskatchewan. Is that
right?
How you say it? Does it even matter how you say it?
No.
Exactly. Screw and that. You have a new hat.
I do.
Mount me?
No, it's a Mountie.
Let me finish a couple beers and we'll get there.
Okay. Hey, now. All right. So let's jump right in there into these subjects here and all this news stuff. Not a lot of attention span on my part towards the news, but I really this week started pouring in to give you all a good show, especially since I knew that it'd be Greg and I. Poor Greg, so uneducated.
I am.
He just doesn't know much.
You'd be amazed what you can fake.
I'm just so tired of calling Joe and saying, you know, you're doing a great job while I'm gone, Joe, but it's poor simple Greg. He just can't keep up.
You know, he just wants to nuke the Jews. Is that a big deal?
And we should explain that that's not what he was saying at all.
No.
But that was the extent of the argument that Van Doren tried to paint him into. And I'm just sitting there going... okay, things got out of control fast.
Yeah, you know what's funny is I learned the hard way.
Right.
You never talk practicality with libertarians. The second you bring about reality or practicality is you've already lost and you're about to look like a racist, bigot, homophobe,
right.
Whatever.
Right. You know, before we jump into subjects, I have to say thank you to Travis Week. I never say it right. I'm sorry, Travis.
He's been on the show before.
I know he has. I know. And he is the only active supporter of this program. Travis, and God bless it, I said his name wrong. I apologize to you, Travis, but my friends out in Henry County, just out in the eastern part of Indiana, towards Richmond, towards the Dayton, Ohio, Columbus part there of Indiana, they actually invite me out. I've been gone a year and a half out of the Libertarian Party leadership position, and they're the only ones that call. They're the only ones that write. I love those guys out there. They invited me to their county convention to talk about We Are Libertarians. As predicted, it was unsatisfying and disappointing. It was in the middle of a restaurant, and there was a birthday party next to us, and food was being served while I was talking. It was so distracting. And you know me, I'm like ADD as all get out.
If you had only taken your Adderall.
Oh, that wouldn't have even worked. But it was, you know, there were many people there who had heard my shtick before, but several who had not, and hopefully they are listening to this podcast for the first time. Met a great candidate out there running for State House 54 named Brad Owens. So look him up. But just wanted to say thank you to Travis for asking me out to speak about the program and give a little insight. And I want to thank him for my speaking fee. It isn't often that people actually pay attention to the writer and they provide me with what I ask for and they pay the speaking fee. But, you know, gosh darn it, he went out to Walmart. He bought 24 cans of Fancy Feast and 5 bags of Temptations cat treats and mittens. And our new little friend here on the program, Cornelius, they're so happy.
They're very happy.
They're very happy.
Now, you know what? God bless libertarians. Their adherence to principles,
that's right,
by abandoning fiat currency like the U.S. dollar and paying you in cat food, that is true believer right there. That's better than Bitcoin.
It's not only currency. It's also prepper material.
It is, absolutely.
If things go bad, you all can come to my house because Mittens, Cornelius, and I have enough food to last us through the winter.
I'm only bringing bacon strips. That's all I'm bringing over.
So it was very, very cool of Travis, and I wanted to thank him right up front here. So let's get into it. There's a little bit of spat in the Liberty movement today. It sort of broke when Ron Paul wrote an article on March 17th about Crimea seceding, and he's also been doing interviews, as Ron Paul does, talking about U.S. foreign policy, and has framed a lot of this as a failure of U.S. foreign policy on an overarching scale. I really don't feel like we have to explain too much of what Ron Paul believes about foreign policy to people who listen to this program, but I do want to read, I'm going to read two things to you. They're very short. And so they won't take very long, but this is the March 17th article by Ron Paul in the USA Today. And Ron Paul writes, "Residents of Crimea voted over the weekend on whether they would remain an autonomous region of Ukraine or join the Russian Federation. In doing so, they joined a number of countries and regions, including recently Scotland, Catalonia, and Venice, that are seeking to secede what they view as an unresponsive or oppressive governments. These latter three are participating without much notice, while the overwhelming Crimea vote to secede from the Ukraine has incensed the U.S. and European officials and has led NATO closer to conflict with Russia than it has since the height of the Cold War. So what's the big deal?" Ron Paul asks to the USA Today readers. "Opponents of the Crimea vote like to point to the illegality of the referendum," which, if there's anything that I know, Greg, that I learned while I was gone, you can trust a Russian election.
Absolutely.
"But self-determination is a centerpiece of international law. Article 1 of the UN Nations Charter points out clearly that the purpose of the UN is to develop friendly relations among nations based on respect for the principle of equal rights and self-determination of peoples. So why does the U.S. care which flag will be hoisted on a small piece of land thousands of miles away? Critics point to the Russian occupation of Crimea as evidence that no fair vote could have taken place. Where were these people when an election held in Iraq, occupied by U.S. troops, was called a triumph of democracy? Perhaps the U.S. officials who supported the unconstitutional overthrow of the Ukraine's government should refocus their energies on learning our own constitution, which does not allow the U.S. government to overthrow governments overseas or send $1 billion to bail out the Ukraine or its international creditors. The last two paragraphs here. Though the Obama administration has applied some minimal sanctions on selected Russian and Crimean individuals, neither the U.S. nor the EU can afford significant sanctions against Russia. Global trade provides too much economic benefit to both sides. Indeed, international markets rallied on the news that the sanctions would be thus far minimal. They understand that trade and economic engagement are the surest roads to peace and prosperity. Let's hope governments will follow their lead. Anything that I read that really kind of stood out to you?
A lot of things I thought were incorrect.
Okay.
I really did. And I thought, for one, to me, this has been a, one, like you said, Russia doesn't exactly believe in fair and or free elections whatsoever. What they do believe in is nationalism.
Right.
And nationalism is one of the most powerful things driving this entire crisis.
And isn't it terrible when a country exports its own nation's values?
Well, unless it's freedom, and we're in the United States.
By the way, Saturn, apparently one of Saturn's moons, has 5 times the oil of the Earth.
I bet you anything there's a rocket that can get to Saturn in the private market.
Because we're about
immediately
to free the S out of them.
Darn right. They need freedom.
So...
No, but I mean, Ron Paul, like, this is the thing, is this, Ron Paul is looking at it, yes, in principle, yes, Crimea deserves to determine their fate. And really, individuals, obviously, we're libertarians, we believe individuals deserve to determine their fate. But in no way, shape, or form does this improve freedom, civil rights, economic freedom for the people of Crimea whatsoever.
Right.
This is a nationalistic move. And to me, this sort of... cements my belief that nature abhors a vacuum. The United States and President Obama has very much believed that if we open up markets and we interlink ourselves with other economies through the free market, that peace will be the result. That the more interwoven you two are, the more trade exists, the more you'll understand each other, and the less likely you'll go to war. The only thing is, that's a great theory, and it's worked quite a bit, but what if it doesn't?
Right.
And right now what I see is a leader who actually, his economy was actually struggling, was actually slumping, Russia's was, and Putin needed, he wanted to, but he needed to give Russia a shot in the arm. He wanted to reestablish their presence as a global superpower.
Yeah, the Olympics was not about Russia showing Russia off to the world necessarily as much as it was Russia showing off to itself, kind
exactly.
of making itself feel better about itself. Getting some nationalistic pride swirled up, and then this, where it's Putin against the West, and it's painted in the Russian papers as our great hero Putin is taking on the United States and the European Union, and they're creating it's this us versus them narrative. You know, Russians have a very strong sense of, they have always been the redheaded stepchild of Western society.
Yep.
You know, they have always been the ones in World War One or World War Two. Well, send the Russians to the front lines. Who gives a crap about them? You know, it's always been an uneducated society. They've always been behind on technology. And their entire history, and you saw it in the Olympic opening ceremonies, was about building up their national ego, building up their national pride to let's be honest, legitimize the failures that have been their governments, especially in the 20th century.
And in geopolitics, this is an exercise in letting people save face. The United States, after the Cold War, in President Reagan was more guilty of this than anyone else, stands up on a world stage and says, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down that wall." When you hit someone's ego, when you hit a nation's pride, in the short run, yeah, you might improve things geopolitically. But a lot of times you have someone like Vladimir Putin, who is a former KGB operative and who understands the importance of walking tall as a Russian citizen. And you created a monster because you wanted an absolute victory. And like the Russians aren't like the Chinese. The Chinese literally refuse to play a role on the global stage in foreign policy unless it involves economics. They are as practical as it gets. Vladimir Putin understands that the more power you're perceived to yield, the more powerful you are. Mm-hmm. China could, honestly, they could just, they could flip Russia. They could buy Russia,
right?
You know, fix it up and then split it up into little Soviet satellites again. But Vladimir Putin understands that by outplaying President Obama, and then Obama made a huge mistake by going after Medvedev, the former prime minister before mm-hmm. him, or president before him, that's who he wanted to develop a relationship with, because that's who he wanted to elevate within their society right. as the leader. That was a miscalculation. By yeah. not acting, by sliding Putin that way, he created his own monster.
Mm-hmm. So this leads us to Students for Liberty, which, you know, Students for Liberty and Young Americans for Liberty are two the two most prominent youth groups within the Liberty movement. Young Americans for Liberty, our good friend Creighton Harrington works with them, works
an
for
official
them.
Show sponsor, right?
He's yeah. They're an official show sponsors. They personally pay me for every time. No, it's a joke. It's a joke. That joke, by the way, dates back to when Creighton was just volunteering, and they work these kids up into such a frenzy about 501c3s and all this, and the tax man will come get us if you say this or that. And so Creighton would just freak out when we'd say, yeah, YAL sponsors this program. Shut up, man. Shut up. So it's still funny. It makes us laugh. We don't care if any of you people get it.
Well, we would care not at all if Creighton lost his job over it. That's
right.
A him problem.
Yeah, that's a him problem.
We are libertarians.
Young Americans for Liberty are more Ron Rand Paul.
They're more Rand.
More Rand. They're more conservative. They're
Ted Cruz, Amash, that crowd.
With all due respect to my good man, Creighton Harrington, they are heading down that road, that Karl Rove, young college Republican working in the basement of the RNC for Goldwater, hardcore libertarian values, and now he's Karl Rove. You know,
it's compassionate conservatism.
Right. So it just, you know, stand fast to your principles, young men and women. And then there's the Students for Liberty, which is a much older group, much more grounded. YAL is much more politically minded. And that's why they sort of tend to float towards people like Rand Paul, Justin Amash, because they want direct action in elections. Students for Liberty is a little more philosophical in its nature.
They're the anchor.
Yeah, some would say that they're left, and maybe there are left libertarians there, but I just think it's because it's more philosophical that it comes across that way.
They won't abandon civil libertarianism as right. quickly as certain right. elements of the liberty movement will.
Right. So, Students for Liberty, led by Alexander McCobin, who is a co-founder of the group, put out a statement today criticizing Ron Paul. And this is from BuzzFeed, from Rosie Gray, who writes, criticizing Paul, who has characterized Crimea's largely unrecognized referendum as a secession and has called for the U.S. not to act against Russia in this crisis. And so McCobin praises Rand Paul, which is interesting because of the rumors that we hear of the tension between, you know, SFL and the Rand Paul folks. So this is what McCobin wrote. And this won't be long, so I try not to bore you, but I think it's interesting. While it's important to criticize misconduct of the U.S. and some of its Western allies exacerbating the turmoil in the Middle East over the past two decades, it is also important to remember that there are other aggressors in the world. Russia, with its ongoing wars in the Northern Caucasus, the invasion of South Ossetia, and the most recent annexation of Crimea being key among them. Former Congressman Ron Paul, and man, is this a statement that I couldn't agree with more, and that I have said repeatedly on this show. Former Congressman Ron Paul, whose views are interpreted by many as wholly representative of the libertarian movement, gets it wrong when he speaks of Crimea's right to secede. Make no mistake about it, Crimea was annexed by Russian military force at gunpoint, and its supposedly democratic referendum was a farce. Besides a suspiciously high voter turnout, with legitimate international observers, the referendum gave Crimeans only two choices: join Russia now or later. And what I agreed with was that people see Ron Paul as the spiritual father of all libertarians.
And to be honest, you really just challenge his kingship of libertarians, since you are, in fact, the rightful leader.
Listen here, Ron Paul, the president of all libertarians is coming for you. If you want to hear that story, I'll tell that at the very end and explain that joke. It's much too simplistic to solely condemn the U.S. for any kind of geopolitical instability in the world. Non-interventionists that sympathize with Russia by condoning Crimea secession and blaming the West for Ukrainian crisis failed to see the larger picture. Putin's government is one of the least free in the world and is clearly the aggressor in Crimea, as it was even beforehand with its support of the Yanukovych regime that shot and tortured its own citizens in the street of Kiev. The recent spate of anti-war activists arrested in Russia is just one of the many examples that illustrate that the Russian Federation is not a free country, and everyone should be very careful with showing sympathies to an autocratic leader such as President Putin. In contrast to his father, Senator Rand Paul gets it right by condemning Russian aggression while not subscribing to hawkish calls for military intervention at the same time. It is one thing to not intervene. It is another thing to applaud an autocrat for the sake of blaming our own government. Do you, and let me, I thought this was kind of interesting, what's added to the BuzzFeed article here. And no, it's not 17 reasons that Students for Liberty hates Ron Paul. But one of the SFL spokespeople, Frederick Roeder, writes, "But we think that it's important to condemn what Russia's doing. Russia is one of the least free places in the world. In the Ukrainian case, it's obviously not the U.S. government who is the aggressor, but the Russian government who have invaded parts of a sovereign nation," Roeder said. "I think there are a lot of people who get confused by this, including Ron Paul and some libertarians who would say, oh, that's secession. But we did not observe a secession from Crimea, but a military annexation," Roeder said. He added that Students for Liberty had organized a protest outside the Russian embassy in Berlin last week. Our thoughts and prayers go out to all of those students
who are now missing,
who are now sick.
Yeah.
SFL comes out, long and short of it, to summarize a long story. SFL came out and said, you know, we don't have to constantly blame the United States government, even when clearly the United States government didn't do anything in this case to have a direct cause. Maybe, you know, there's always cause and effect in foreign policy, but we're not the one rolling tanks into Crimea. We're not the ones, you know, forcing Putin to invade this country. You know,
we're only helping overthrow the Ukrainian elected government.
It's non-direct by giving them lots and lots and lots of money. We weren't the reason the tanks rolled in there. There's certainly... All right, well, I'm not going to lie to you. We took a quick break, and I completely forgot what I was talking about.
Well, sometimes you got to kick the rest off.
Yeah. I'm normally really good about remembering exactly where I left, like mid-sentence. I can stop and remember.
Canadian brainwashing.
Later. I think it's because Gina's not here. Gina's my rock.
But no, we're talking about the annexation of Crimea.
Yeah. So Putin is clearly a dictator, and we talked about this on the program.
You called it earlier. I didn't believe he was. A year ago, you said it, and I didn't believe it.
I didn't go back and pull the audio just because I didn't have time, but it was at the very end of one of the shows in one of the things where, you know, at our soapbox at the end, I said, listen, watch out for this dude, because he's clearly an autocratic leader. He's clearly somebody who it could be the next great dictator.
Mm-hmm.
And here's a guy who now, fast forward, is creating as much national pride as he can. He's clearly identifying an enemy, which is us, to stir up nationalistic pride. Now he's invading countries. And I wish I had saved it, but there was a great Tom Clancy. I saw it on Reddit earlier this week, and it was from a Tom Clancy novel where he said, you know, Putin will come in and invade Crimea. And then he'll go to Hungary and the Czech Republic and Poland, and had it all outlined about what domino would fall next. And, you know, here's a guy who I really think is a very evil man. He clearly has the resources to do a lot of damage. I think he's a very serious problem. But is he our problem? Whose problem is he? This is the evergreen question. This is the difficulty of foreign policy when you're a libertarian, is whose problem is it? Is it nobody's problem? And, you know, I think the Malaysian airplane thing, it really kind of was a great example of foreign policy the way it ought to be conducted, okay? Nations work together for the good of humanity without any beef, without any questions. You know, the Russians, the Australians, the Chinese, the Malaysians, the Americans, the Canadians, the British.
Well, let's not go that far. Yeah. The Canadians were involved.
I'm fairly certain that it was them. But
I said that to someone.
Listen, I'm just saying the plane could make it all the way to Canada on a full tank of fuel.
That's what I told John Yuan that it was the Great White Menace.
I heard that on Fox News, so it must be true, right?
You've been hanitized.
Uh-huh. I'm a great American. So, but they work. We as a world community, because we, meaning you and I, clearly had a lot to do with it, came together for the benefit of mankind to solve a problem, a short-term problem, or it could be long-term problems, without sitting there, trying to play games and do all this BS. Whereas this Crimea situation, it's just the exact opposite. You know, I agree with Ron Paul. I don't really care what happens to Crimea. I know that's very fat, piggish, selfish American me, but they're not invading our doorsteps. When does foreign policy become a problem? When it comes to your doorstep, is what Ron Paul would outline. I don't agree with Ron Paul that, American foreign policy is a direct result. Now, what we do afterwards is where Ron Paul is right, where it's like, listen, why are we sending billions of our own money to the Ukraine, to try and have influence? But that's sort of the age-old question. And you know what? Students for Liberty is exactly right. It's okay to call a bad guy a bad guy. The United States doesn't always have to be your first knee-jerk response saying, these people, we're so bad, the United States government is so bad. Like, it's okay to say Putin is a bad person, he did a bad thing, and it doesn't mean that you're arguing for interventionism.
Yeah, this is where I have a hard time, and I don't have a hard time saying, like, we should obviously send troops into Crimea, because I don't think that's the right answer ever. But I have a really hard time with this idea that it's not our problem. Because, I wish I could attribute to who it's to, but it was a female writer, and it was about the Holocaust, and it was, first they came for them, and it wasn't, don't worry, it's not us. Then they came for X, and then it's not us, and I'll look it up, because I'm kind of butchering it. But the point was, we never worried about it until they were on our doorstep. And when we were out at DePaul, when Ron Paul came and spoke, and I got to ask him a few questions, it was actually about Syria, and I asked him, where is your red line? And he said, my red line is when they're at our doorstep. And for me, that is, I would rather much, even if we're not going to be, I'd rather be not isolationist, but non-interventionist, but extremely strong. I believe very much that I want to be feared. I don't want to go out and necessarily be the world police ever, but I want them to think that, oh my gosh, if we ever hit them, we're in so much trouble. That we better not wake the bear from slumber.
Yeah, but we have a feared military. Our foreign policy clearly is not feared because it is so widespread that it has become inept. It's become a joke. It's what is Obama going to do? Draw a red line?
No.
And there's no clear leader in Syria. I mean, at this point. Assad is the leader there, but he's not really the leader like Putin, where Putin has the entire nation, for the most part, behind him and stirs up this national support. He's got support from other nations. It's a different ballgame than Syria.
And I'm saying that was a strategic mistake made over years that we got into ourselves into a position where we didn't have any leverage. If we had leverage, if we had financial leverage, if we had military leverage, if we had any kind of leverage whatsoever, you can keep Putin from becoming the expansionist autocrat that he probably wants to be.
But isn't that Monday morning quarterback where you're kind of sitting there saying, oh, well, we shouldn't have gotten to this position? You know, it's hindsight a little bit.
I don't know. I mean,
how?
I think we're predictable. That's what bothers me. And I've said this before on the podcast. What I loved about, and I didn't like Richard Nixon. I'm not saying I love Nixon. But he let it slip that he was suffering from a mental instability and was thinking about dropping the bomb. And when you create that, you know, it's like Machiavelli. You create an environment of unpredictability.
Right.
People are much more hesitant to move.
Right.
And President Obama has embraced a worldview that he can work things out, that we can interlock markets, we can talk, we can work things out where it's economically beneficial for everyone. There are certain men in this world, and that's been the course of history, that you can't negotiate with.
Right. And doesn't Putin seem to be one of those people?
He is. And I don't think we should hit him. I mean, I don't think we invade. All that's a waste of time, and it'll serve no purpose whatsoever. But what you do, and you send that to him. No. You have to scare him and show that you're a threat and that you're dead serious. Oh.
Oops, that was harder than
you just knocked your cat down.
Oh, she's all right. She's tough. She's been through a lot lately.
But if you're not perceived as a threat, I really do think you are. The United States has clearly lost ground in the world. In George W. Bush, people were afraid of. Yeah, he invaded Iraq and Afghanistan for no reason whatsoever.
Right, but that, none of that is good.
That isn't good. It isn't good. But you can let them think. That's what I mean. Right. You don't need to do it, but you need to let people think and be scared to death that you might export freedom to a cave near them.
It's what Glenn Beck calls the twitchy eye. You
exactly.
Just got that little bit of a twitchy eye.
Exactly, because people won't mess with you if you're crazy.
Right.
You know, put Sarah Palin. That's why I said, you know, you put Sarah Palin in.
No.
Nobody's messing with Sarah Palin.
I'm sorry, but this episode of We Are Libertarians has officially been canceled and Greg Lenz has been fired.
I don't mean as president. I'm just saying you make her
Secretary of Defense.
Bring back Secretary of War. Right. Let's bring that name back. We'll name Sarah Palin and we'll call it the bulldog position or a pit bull. The pit bull with lipstick.
Sounded kind of sexy. Yeah. I think that is one of the worst ideas you've ever had.
No, and it is a bad idea, but I think you get the principle I'm talking about. I don't think it's right. And the responsibility is the Crimean people.
The problem of what you're saying is how do you create that? You can't create that. It just exists. You know, it's a person like George Bush is, you know, I don't know. I don't buy. He was a terrible foreign policy president.
And, oh, for sure.
And he was a terrible domestic president. And he was terrible on everything that libertarians care about. He just took the imperial presidency and just put the gas pedal to the floor. And Obama has found another gear. I don't know how, but.
I mean, they don't.
Heaven forbid Hillary gets elected.
They don't fear President Obama. And I mean, they probably should. Like, if Russia were a bunch of caves in the Middle East, you know, then they would be the drones would be all over the place, you know?
Right.
But unfortunately, Putin is, and he's actually better. He's a better politician. He's he's more insightful. He's sharper, and he's outplayed President Obama this entire time.
His entire presidency. At every step, it's somebody said this week. I forget who it was. Putin's been playing chess while we're playing checkers.
Rogers from the...
Mike Rogers.
Yeah, Mike Rogers.
And doesn't that really seem to be a consistent theme with Obama's presidency, where he just gets outplayed at every single step?
Bill Clinton said it during the campaign. Mm-hmm. He is the amateur.
Yep, he is. And so was George Bush. I mean, let's be fair. You know, he was... who wasn't amateur was Donald Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Cheney, all those guys. But, you know, and Obama doesn't really have any of those old guard people around except for people like Podesta and some of those folks. But
it's scary, though, because I doubt he stops here. I bet you anything. I read today on Business Insider his next move is going to eastern Ukraine, which already wants to side with Russia anyway.
Yeah.
Moldova. That's his next move.
Yep. Moldova came out. Part of Moldova came out today and said that they want to be part of Russia. If they want to be part of Russia, I'm sure there are people within that country who don't want to be part of Russia. And here's the interesting thing to me. You've got Venice, you've got Crimea, Moldova, the other country that he listed. What was the other?
Belarus.
You've got these countries. You know, we've talked about it. We've talked about the pre-World War I history and the moves that nations make. Specifically, if you go back and listen to the episode of where we interview Ron Paul, we talked a lot about this in that episode, where these moves are being made and the map is changing. Like, it just, when we go about our daily lives, we don't think about the map changing. You know, it's just what is on the map is set. And now it's starting to shift a little bit. You're seeing these geopolitical shifts. You're seeing things break up. It's not because of civil wars, necessarily. It's, you know, I wouldn't really classify Crimea as a civil war.
It's wealth.
Yeah.
That's what this is. Ukraine right. was on the verge of a debt crisis. Europe can't offer the financial aid package that Russia can.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, wealthy, obviously, the golden rule is that he who has the gold card makes right. the rules. And Russia has, and their economy is slowing, but he has plenty of money. Russia's doing well. They can bail out the Ukraine. They can offer cheap gas. And then that's the eerie part, though, is now all of a sudden you're talking about pipelines that go into Europe.
Right.
And all of a sudden, all the benefits of being U.S. allies, you get, and Putin decides to put economic sanctions on the EU. The citizens start, you know, they see, well, man, what if we just took the Russian package, why are we sticking with the Americans?
Right.
The world becomes pretty hostile.
Yeah, it becomes, we're on the verge of a Cold War.
Exactly.
And you know what? Putin is the type of guy that doesn't mind putting a few million bodies up against ours.
It's the cost of doing business for
right.
him.
Right. He doesn't consider Russians to be, you know, it's his power. He is that type of guy. And he controls Europe because he controls the natural gas and the oil and the resources, and the Europeans have put themselves in a terrible position. And man, if it's going to be Russia with China in the mix versus the Europeans and the Americans, I'm not feeling confident about that situation.
And that's, you know, the play if I'm an American foreign policy expert. Right now, China literally is agnostic.
Mm-hmm.
Where can we get the cheapest resources, right. and would you shut up and quit disrupting trade routes?
Right.
They are by far the most pragmatic world power in long, 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 long time.
Yeah.
And
well, they need to be. They need to be stable because they're on a verge of collapse themselves
exactly.
because of their population.
And they're older than we are.
Right.
And yet they need growth, they need wage growth, they need all these things. But if China's ever going to get involved, it's going to be as a consequence of economic, I guess you could say, disruptions.
Uh-huh.
You know, and that's almost what we need to do. We need to say, listen, do you really want 1.1 billion people that you are borders with that are as pragmatic as it gets? And that swings both ways. They feel the same way about human life as they do about conducting transactions. Do you really want to make them mad? Do you want to talk about nationalism when you have a group of people who see for the first time in their country's history since Mao a little bit of sunlight on the horizon, and they see they're starting to be proud?
Right.
You know, Chinese billionaires are popping up all over the place. That is not a fight that Vladimir Putin wants.
Right.
At whatsoever. Because if they decide we're not buying your stuff, he won't even be able to unload that to Europe for pennies on the dollar.
Well, part of what I talked about a year ago was the Paulson recounting of this dinner that he had with the Chinese, where the Hank Paulson was the Treasury Secretary, and this was right after the collapse.
Mm-hmm.
This was right after the financial meltdown. So it would have been November, December-ish, when the Treasury Secretary of China came to visit our Treasury Secretary. And he essentially leans over in the middle of this dinner and says, listen, Russia wanted us to have basically carry out a terrorist attack on our currency where we unload all of your Treasury bills on you, and we call in those notes, both Russia and China, because Russia holds a lot of our notes as well, and we financially collapse the United States and then become the two superpowers in the world, and the United States is ruined. And China said the only thing standing between Vladimir Putin and his desires is us. And Putin just said, or Putin, might as well be. Paulson said, that just chilled me to the core. And I think that is a horrific sign. You know, it shows you where... I think that one story really illustrates where the Russians and Putin, their direction lies, and the Chinese realize they're holding the cards.
Oh, yeah. The person with the money always holds the cards.
They have the financial... They have the bodies, they have the financial resources, the minerals, the gold. They own our debt. We depend on them for trade. And as Peter Schiff talks about in his fantastic book, How an Economy Grows and Why It Crashes, once China figures out that they have a middle class that they can sell to, why are they worrying about giving away their goods and selling to the Americans when they could just enrich their own country?
Yep.
Right now they need us. They need us for jobs. Eventually they won't.
No. Now the big thing is, will they ever let their currency appreciate to the point
right.
their middle class comes up? And that's, if they do have a middle class, they're going to want more civil freedoms.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I mean, it's inevitable, I think. I really right. do think in China it's inevitable. But I don't know. Let me ask you, if you are in a libertarian, if you're in a part of a libertarian administration in the United States, and you right now are John Kerry, what do you go tell? What is your advice to the president?
That might be it. I really struggle with it. And this is one of those, you know, this is one of the tough parts about libertarianism. And this is, you know, I heard Joe mention Casey Hendrickson say that nothing is not an answer. Well, sometimes nothing is an answer. And Casey's just wrong. And Joe should have said, no, you're wrong. Because you have to look at the ends, okay? You know, you can try and do what Kerry's doing and do all these peace talks and try and structure some of the conversations amongst world leaders. That's probably about as involved as I'd want to get. And you try to determine what really is happening on the ground. Do the people of Crimea, like, is the vote legitimate or not? You know, and you don't look, in my mind, you wouldn't look at it like, well, what's best for us? So then that's what we're going to say. Because I think a lot of times our foreign policy is like, well, it'd be better for us to say if it's illegitimate or not. You know, so ultimately, I'm not willing to commit troops, and I don't necessarily believe in economic sanctions. I believe that economic sanctions are an act of war. Because the best way to, just like the Students for Liberty said, the best way to fix the situation is with solid economic growth. And that's here and there. And if you put all these sanctions on Russia, then that has the opposite effect of helping. All that does is kind of help clamp down, help Vladimir Putin clamp down. So, you know, I wouldn't recommend sanctions.
But if you're like my Secretary of Defense, and I'm waiting for your recommendation, what are you going to tell me?
Yeah, but Secretary of Defense...
Or Secretary of State.
Secretary of State. I would say that this is all on the Europeans, that this is largely their problem, that they're the ones who have to take the lead on this, and they have to negotiate with Putin to find out his true intentions. I think a lot of that is... You know, Chamberlain, Hitler, Part Two,
Berlin,
right? And the British Foreign Secretary Jack Straw, or whoever it is now, will come home with the we've signed peace accords. I don't think there is a lot that the United States can do beyond saying the Europeans are in the lead and we're going to back them up because they're our strategic allies. I think it would be interesting. If they kick Russia out of the G8, that's under talks right now. Obama's, I don't know if he's leaking that or if he's seriously actually considering recommending that it become the G7 again and that they kick Russia out of the IMF, which I think would be ballsy, actually, of Obama for once, but which is why I don't think it's going to happen.
I mean... like for me, they kick them out of the G8. But this is one of those things where, regardless, Europe has mm-hmm. got to have energy. Right. The whole world runs on energy. They have yep. got to have it. They don't for the most part. Like, they, you know, Finland and Denmark, they've dabbled in this, you know, renewable energy, and with enough subsidies, anything's affordable. But if they don't get it, there is one way to do it. And this is what I was thinking about a lot last night. I was thinking, how would I solve this? There's one answer. Syria. The whole reason, and now this is off Zero Hedge, but the whole reason this little Syrian conflict happened is Yemen is dying, and I mean dying, to build natural gas and oil pipelines through Syria into Europe, so there are two providers. Right now, Russia owns Syria. You know, Assad helped manage hang on to power because of Vladimir Putin. If I am the United States government, I will, through back channels, going to contact Bashar al-Assad and say, listen to this. We will back you. You have to make certain civil reforms. But honestly, he's better than the alternative, like from a civil libertarian perspective.
Unfortunately, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he is the lesser of two evils. He's still evil, but he is the lesser of the two.
Right.
And so I go to Assad and I say, how would you like to cement your leadership over this nation? We will sell you the weapons that you're going to need to hold on to your power. Here's the deal, though. You're opening up a big old pipeline that's going to go right through Syria, coming through the Middle East. Because if anything, we need to interlink our futures with the Middle East, if that's the policy we're going to believe in, bringing markets together. And then all of a sudden, Russia has a competitor to Europe. Putin has way less influence over there. And we don't have to, we can say, great, go sell to China. If you don't like negotiating with Europe, go see how you like dealing with the Chinese.
But do you think that Putin is going to allow that to happen, or do you think that that would have a cause and effect in some other place where he would try to stop your plan from happening?
How, I mean, in this perspective, we can come out and, in my opinion, we can support, like, the Al-Nusra Front, which, you know, I'm not huge fans of.
You support Al-Qaeda? He would, or we would?
Well, you saw Charlie Wilson's war. You do it through back channels.
Oh, boy.
What? That's how the Russians lost last time.
My problem.
There aren't any good options.
I know that's always the problem when we get to this subject. When we get to foreign policy, is that there are no good options, and there are no options where America makes the moral play. The only moral play is sometimes the closest to a moral play is to not get involved, and even that's complicated because in a case like Syria, people are being gassed to death. And you're just going to let them die?
Mm-hmm.
You're going to let Hitler kill 6 million Jews and 6 million...
Pretend you're Switzerland and say, what do you mean what happened? Where did this gold come from?
You know, it's... What is the moral answer? And, you know, this program is not always the best at telling you exactly what you ought to believe. Unless Maya's here.
Well, the real answer is for the Crimean people to say, no, we're going to lead ourselves. Right. Why don't you guys shut up?
Right.
We have our own. That's the real answer.
Who's the strong man in Crimea that's going to be their leadership?
Yeah. Where are these the people that believe in self-governance and determine their own future? If they're not going to stand up, and we should support them if they exist. And that's always, in my opinion, the libertarian answer. But we haven't been able to identify them because they're either under the threat of Putin's black bags or... Yeah, well, creepy Crowley.
Okay, so anything left? So who do you side with more, SFL or Ron Paul?
Oh, SFL for sure. Ron Paul, that's, don't get me wrong, in principle, I totally do. Unfortunately, we don't live in theoretical land.
Mm-hmm.
People are dying.
Yeah.
People are going to die, and he's going to continue marching.
Right.
He will not stop. And the only leverage that I see, in my opinion, is Syria, and we make a unbelievable deal with the devil, with Bashar al-Assad, but it'll make Israel happy, it'll make Yemen happy, and all of a sudden, Vladimir Putin doesn't hold all of Europe underneath a gun.
Right. You embolden one strong man with regional desires over one massively...
But you build him in his own little kingdom.
Right, massively powerful, which... Again, has been the problem, and the problem with your argument is blowback, is the people that are going to be murdered and killed by Assad once he regains full power, that fosters movements who then blame you for intervention. I mean, so that's the fault with your argument.
Oh, and there is tons of fault in my argument, but to me, it's the only thing I see available that has us not allowing Putin to just grow and consolidate his power.
Right. Okay, well, we have no answers for you.
Rainbows.
So if you, I know there's probably somebody right now screaming at their pad pod zune.
they have those in Idaho? Because I bet you it's Josiah.
Write us in. We'd love to get your questions. If you've got questions for us, please write us in. Spangle, S-P-A-N-G-L-E, at We Are Libertarians, or editor at WeAreLibertarians.com. Let's finish up with Fred Phelps. This extraordinary scumbag died this week. But I have a question for you that is going to probably piss some people off, but I think that it needs to be asked. I saw somebody ask it on Facebook. What did Fred Phelps ever really do wrong? I was like, well, obviously, he's the guy that hates fags guy. He was the guy that protested soldiers' funerals. And the person went on to post, he never actually hurt anybody. He just had opinions that were wrong. So why is he the bad guy when we have a president that continually bombs and kills and drones and, you know,
well, if the kills. Comparison is that, then he is a schoolboy, you
right.
know.
We have a president that can. What was the wedding that?
Oh, they drone strike. Yeah, the Yemen. It was a wedding in Yemen.
Right.
And they exhibited signature patterns, signature
right.
strike.
And how many people, women and children, died?
Oh God, at least 30. 40.
Right. And that is morally okay to our society, but a guy who has an opinion that 99%, 99.5%. of our society does not agree with is the most villainous person in our society.
His villainization is his approach.
Right.
He doesn't give people, like, he doesn't consider anything sacred.
So before people think that I am agreeing with Fred Phelps or say, I don't want anybody to have any kind of cross signals here, I just thought that it was an interesting thought about Fred Phelps is that, you know, he never actually violated the non-aggression principle. He had opinions that everybody hated. He was a tremendous scumbag in how he presented himself. He completely misrepresented a religion and pissed everybody off along the way, especially the last few years. And he is a cult leader. Their movement, I mean, the Kevin Smith movie, did you see the Kevin Smith movie about...
No, I never
sort
saw
of the
it.
Knockoff of the
Westboro
Baptist Church. Man, Red.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. Red State.
Red State, which was a great movie. Check out Red State. And he basically puts the Fred Phelps situation in, and it's a cult. But he didn't actually kill anybody. He didn't punch anybody. He didn't actually walk up and hit anybody. He just had opinions that were wrong. You know, and I think that's it's the Walter Block argument is what are we really upset about? Why are we really upset about Klan members when, by and large, they don't the Klan members today just have opinions that are wrong.
And that's not I mean, that's an impossible. I mean, because the Klan has a history of doing things wrong. Like Fred Phelps, Westboro Baptist Church has never committed physical violence against
right.
an individual.
But they are morally outrageous while we have people in our own government. And because it's perpetrated by the government, it is okay that they do things that are immoral according to the non-aggression principle.
For sure. I mean, but that's the nature of public opinion.
Right.
You know, anytime something's popular, it's okay to violate your... to, I guess to make the... what would you call that? The case that it's okay to abandon your principles in this one time because
sure.
it's popular.
Right.
You know, but Fred Phelps never did anything that violated the non-aggression principle.
So
he lacked in tact by doing it
right.
when a time a family's grieving.
So how do we get to a place in society where it's not okay to hold the opinions that Fred Phelps holds and it's not okay to, like I view Fred Phelps as... And I know that people, it happens all the time. You say this, you bring up these topics, and people don't listen to the disclaimers. I don't think that Fred Phelps was a good human being. I am glad that he is currently in a Saddam Satan situation similar to South Park right now.
I want to ask you the question. Chris, do you still go to the Westboro Baptist Church, or have you since stopped attending?
No. No. I feel like they are profiteers. They are lawyers by trade. And wasn't he like some...
He was a civil rights lawyer that helped get, according to him, keep in mind, he's the self self-proclaimed man in Kansas that got Jim Crow laws stricken down because he worked for the NAACP.
But his daughter, the one that's going to take over, is a lawyer. And basically the rap is to be tremendous scumbags. So people violate their civil rights. Then they sue the people that violate their city rights, whether it's on First Amendment issues usually. And then that's how they've made all their money.
Oh, yeah, they're provocateurs.
They're provocateurs is exactly right. They probably don't even believe their own shtick, honestly. They just say this stuff so they could get money out of lawsuits, and we have fallen for it. But I just thought it was a really interesting point that I wanted to bring up that, sometimes I don't think we think about what is morally acceptable. Where are our boundaries? It's not okay for somebody to hold an opinion that is offensive, but it's okay for this entity to harm someone, to take someone else's rights, because they're the government. So, I don't know.
No, it's an interesting framework to think about it that way. Because the government, in the case of Fred Phelps, let's say they protest a Marine's funeral, and they provoke the individuals to the point where they get beat up, and then they want to sue because their First Amendment rights were violated, they're allowed to protest. But with the issues of jury nullification that we talked with about Dr. Thornton, it's very well possible that that jury, there would be a case, it would be by the letter of the law, correct, and the people are like, nope, we're good.
Yeah.
We don't like these people either.
Yeah.
So there has to be a level of principle. And so, can you disagree with the Westboro Baptist Church? For sure. The answer, though, is never to hit them.
Right.
To attack them, you troll them, you mock them and belittle them to the point where they are so hurt to their core, they are so shaken in their foundations that they might even join the First Reformed Church or the Flying Spaghetti Monster.
Right. Like the great sign, it's not even the signs where it's like, it's these displays of like two men kissing or I thought the sign that said, we're sorry for your loss. I think that's infinitely more powerful than trying to be provocative back, trying to outdo them by trying to get their goat or get their goat, however it's said. I don't know why you want to get somebody's goat. But, somebody stood outside and had sympathy for them, or making them irrelevant with the motorcycle guys that go around and block them out and make them irrelevant.
I mean, send a group of gay nude men to dance on them outside the funeral. Like, why would you ever want to resort to violence when you could have so much more fun just trolling them? We lived through this with the Facebook and Google chat little incident.
Too soon. Like the greatest thing ever was painting the house across the street in rainbow colors.
Yes.
Hilarious.
Exactly. Or buy up all the land right around their church, every penny, and then turn it into a homosexual community for retirees with 5 o'clock nude hour. why would I just never give them that satisfaction?
You know what? Sometimes your ideas I don't agree with. Other times I like it. What was I going to say? Scumbags.
Yes, they're scumbags. And I was reading, I'd never really paid attention to them whatsoever. I know a good friend of ours on the Obsessive Viewer, Anthony Tiny Ramian, nothing makes him madder than the Westboro Baptist Church.
Really?
He is the nicest person you'll ever meet, but my God, he would go around and just start, he'd conduct vigilante justice like the
Dark
Knight.
Is it because he is a Christian and they represent the faith in an inaccurate
way?
He's
an atheist.
Or he just gets offended by them.
He just finds them morally reprehensible.
Right.
And that's actually kind of something interesting. There's a little side thing that I find interesting, but we'll continue with this and I'll ask it at the end.
I just don't get offended by much.
You worked in radio and politics. It's impossible to offend you.
I just don't. If I see them, I just go, okay, whatever. There's not much that offends me. And I feel like in our society, I saw some article, Beyonce went to the Anne Frank house in Amsterdam, or maybe it was in New York or whatever. And so Beyonce wanted to make sure that she was important and wanted to honor Anne Frank by posing next to Anne Frank, which is just like the height of narcissism. I'm going to honor her by having my photo taken with her. And it was a photo of Anne Frank that she was next to.
Shouldn't she have hidden?
So the article was in the Huffington Post or one of these online magazines where it's just like the whole internet now is basically just snarky. Like the Huffington Post, all their tweets have personalities. Just like, stop it. And the whole thrust of the argument was, were we offended by this? No, we thought it was beautiful and moving. It was a great tribute. First of all these websites love Beyonce for whatever reason, you know.
And page views.
We won't even get into the band Bossy, where she's married to a guy who says bitch and hoe in every other song. But like their whole attitude is, are we offended? Should someone be offended by these photos or not? It's like, that's the central question that we're going to start asking ourselves as a society, is are we offended? Am I offended? Are you offended? I'm not offended, but somebody might be offended, you know, and it just seems like a lot of these Huffington Post, you know, some of these blogs, I guess you'd call them at this point.
But I mean, that's the incentive for them. Their incentive is to create madness on the internet. Mm-hmm. So they get the page views, right. So they get, you know, they get the most clicks. That's their business model, is sensationalism.
Right.
Is that a good thing?
No, I don't think it is.
That's the free market, though.
I mean, I was on Facebook and somebody posted the Huffington Post, and they're like the worst offenders for me. Have you seen Miley Cyrus's sunburned Instagram photo where she had a sunburn? I'm like, really? Like, who's wasting 5 minutes of their day worrying about if Miley Cyrus has a sunburn? Anyway, sorry, old man rant over.
No, but I mean, it brings up an interesting point to me. And there are two little things. One, if the free market demands it, should we be against it ever?
Right.
Should you, as king of all libertarians, or president, whichever you prefer, Putin of libertarians,
president, please,
president,
I'm
president,
I'm duly elected.
You're duly elected, and I'm sure those are free and fair elections.
All of you.
But should we ever have an issue with that? If that's what society wants, what difference does it make to us? Should you be outraged? If
I am
it's Miley
offended.
Cyrus and not the Westboro Baptist Church?
I mean, I still looked at it, but, you know, it's Miley Cyrus. You can be outraged or mad or disappointed or whatever emotion that you'd like. You know, just don't pass a law about it. Stop using, stop consuming, stop giving them your dollars, stop voting by giving them your dollars, giving them those page views that help them get dollars. You know, just don't pass a law. You know, I can't force them to not put up Miley Cyrus pictures.
Mm-hmm.
I shouldn't pass a decency law on the internet. God forbid. But, you know, that's not my right. My role is not to say, listen, I think that this is information that is not valuable to anyone.
But you still clicked on it.
Well, it's Miley Cyrus. But no, I didn't really click on it, but I just saw it and I was just like, really? Like, who cares? So, so ask your question because we got to wrap up.
Yeah, and this is just I just always find this interesting. And it's actually from the movie The Ides of March with George Clooney and Ryan Gosling. Did you ever see that movie? It was about politics?
No, I'm sorry, I'm straight.
No, it was a political movie.
Oh, okay.
With Paul Giamatti and Philip Seymour Hoffman.
I always hear Ryan Gosling and I think of The Notebook.
Oh, he's so dreamy.
I know. Abs.
And the question was, and it was a fake like interview, and George Clooney's the Democratic presidential nominee, and Charlie Rose is asking him about capital punishment.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, now, if your wife, and his wife was like sitting out in the, just off of the camera, if your wife were killed in the middle of the night, would you in fact go and try to get retribution over that individual? And he goes, I would. I very much would. I would go and want to kill him. And Charlie Rose goes, but isn't that a bit hypocritical since you don't support capital punishment? And he goes, no. He goes, because society and what the kind of government we want should try to create should be about aspiring to the best in each of us, something right. to attain to. And all of that case would be a crime I'm willing to pay the penalty for.
Right.
Right? So as libertarians that don't believe in, sometimes don't believe in government, various brands of libertarian vodka, where do you stand on that? Where do you see, should a government ever try to create the best we want to attain to?
In that direct example, I completely agree. I'm against capital punishment. I don't think the government should have the ability to take a life ever. The only time that it is morally acceptable is in the case of self-defense, either nationally or, and you know, if you're an open borders person, you don't agree with that, or self-defense if you're trying to break into my home and steal my kitties, then I will kill you. So that's the only time that, that murder is legally permissible, in my mind, is if you are trying to do harm to another, you take the risk. If you try to break into my house to steal my stuff, or if you try to break into my home to physically harm me, you accept the risk that you walk through that door, you may get killed. And if I kill you, it's my right because you're the idiot that tried to break into my house. As far as government trying to craft better outcomes, it's issue by issue, it's case by case. Because in that particular case, I agree with George Clooney. Was it George or
yeah,
Ryan
he was
Gosling?
The candidate.
Yeah, I didn't think Ryan was that deep. But, you know, aspiring to the best of us, well, you know, I think the best in human nature is when a child, a homeless child, is fed. I believe that the best way to do that is through private charity or private or personal interaction. I don't believe that it's best done by the government. What's the most effective way to feed a homeless child? It's not with government. It's not with welfare. It's not with WIC. It's through private means. So in that case, that example, yes. In another case, no.
So it's really hard to have a principle when you kind of got to decide things case by case, don't you feel?
But is that a principle that... But government aspiring to the best of human nature is not one of my principles. It's not a principle of government. That's hopes and fairy wishes. And who wrote that? Was that one of your West Wing show things? With who's that? Who, David Chase? Which guy was that?
Who's that?
Like, who do you like that writes the
oh,
West
Aaron
Wing?
Oh, Aaron Sorkin. I love Aaron Sorkin.
Yeah. Was that Aaron Sorkin that wrote that movie?
Which movie? The Ides of March?
Yeah.
No. Uh-uh. Okay. No, he wrote like A Few Good Men.
Okay.
And You Can't Handle the Truth.
Oh, that is the greatest. Literally, Jack Nicholson, there should be an Oscar for greatest of all time.
Have you ever heard the story behind that either?
Uh-uh.
Aaron Sorkin's sister was Demi Moore mm-hmm. in the JAG Corps, and that was based all off of a true story. And
wow.
He was bartending with Bruce Willis in New York City, like right downtown, and he wrote it on napkins while he waited for plays to get out.
Wow. That's amazing.
I'm sorry. That knowledge will never get
so
you anywhere.
So nerd-tastic. Okay, we got to wrap up. So anything that you'd like to mention that you forgot to mention that you missed, blah, blah, blah?
Watch for the Russian invasion of eastern Ukraine this week.
Okay. The president of all libertarian story. So I was the executive director of the Libertarian Party of Indiana. So my job was to basically I was the caretaker of the libertarian home.
Herd cats.
I was herding cats across the state of Indiana. And before that, I had worked in small-time radio, and I was the producer of the Abdul in the Morning Show, a political talk show, and so I did a lot of interviewing and interaction with many political figures. I'm sorry, I hiccuped. Interacted with many political figures, including one city councilman. And, you know, I try to be a genial, nice person. I have my thoughts and opinions, but I try not to take politics too seriously. So I got along with a lot of Democrats, and there was one Democratic counselor, and met him out on the street one day, and he walked up, and another Democratic counselor walked up behind him, and he goes, "Hey, how are you doing?" I'm like, "I'm great. How are you, counselor?" He's like, "Great, great. Let me introduce you. Counselor X, I'd like to introduce you to the president of all libertarians, Chris Spangle." I was like, "Wow, I don't think I want that responsibility. I don't even like executive director right now."
So even libertarian elections aren't free and fair.
That's
because
right.
Clearly there was no election where you were anointed this role?
To be fair, I started out as Prime Minister of All Libertarians. I then went for a brief time to President of All Libertarians. I'm now back to Prime Minister of All Libertarians. So
you are the Medvedev of Libertarians.
Exactly. Okay, so happy to be back. I mostly missed it. I have enjoyed my time off. I've enjoyed listening to the show. I thought they did a great job while I was gone, and really didn't miss a beat. You guys did a really good job. So,
well, we'll see.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't really.
I can assure you that Josiah Crowns would disagree.
Crunts. I don't know how to say it.
I don't know. Do they even have podcasts in Idaho?
I don't know. What state is it?
Idaho.
Also, I want to say a big shout out. I hope she hears this, and I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to say your last name, and I'm not going to get it right. Samantha Wotiz. Samantha has...
Roads. Samantha, Roods.
We want to congratulate you on having your first child. I believe it's your first child. Dedicated listener to the podcast, avid Galt fan, still has not given up the dream, but neither has he. So, and hopefully we'll see our little buddy soon. We're in talks.
Should we have those little things that Rush has where it says Rush Baby on board, where it says Wall Baby on board?
Oh, Samantha, if you want one of those, let me know.
We'll make you one.
And then, yeah, so my people are talking to Galt's people, and maybe we can make that happen, so we'll see.
How are they doing it?
Well, I had to throw the note over the moat, which was full of non-fluoridated water.
An incredible tinfoil hat you're wearing.
Yeah. All right. No, we love Chris Galt. He's the man. All right, kids. Thank you for having me back. Thank you for making it this far on the podcast. You are a true and dedicated listener of the show. You are also a great American. And as a result, we promise to do
better next time.
Music for We Are Libertarians is provided by Hoosier musician Brian Keith Wallen. Please check out his website, briankeithwallen.com. The song is Bad Spell.